Welcome to Gender Troubles. I'm Emma.
I'm Eva.
And we study gender studies, so you don't have to. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about today, Eva?
Today we are talking about neoliberal feminism. Yes. Or as I have it written here, neoliberal feminism, because I forget that there's a E in there. I like to call this the girl boss apocalypse or the girl apocalypse. It doesn't work at all. Girl bock apocalypse. So let's dive right in. So when we talk about neoliberal feminism, there's kind of three terms that are similar but not necessarily interchangeable. So you have neoliberal feminism, post-feminism, and popular feminism. And there's three scholars who I found who have all written extensively on each of them. Catherine Rottenberg has written a lot about neoliberal feminism. Rosalind Gill has written a lot about post-feminism. And Sarah Bennett-Weiser writes a lot about popular feminism. And together they published an article that's more of like a roundtable conversation, which gives a good overview of these three different types of feminism. And it'll be linked to in the reading list in the show notes. So neoliberal feminism, post-feminism, and popular feminism are distinct yet also heavily tangled terms, and we don't have time to wade into the minutiae of all of it. However, kind of here are the broad strokes, according to the three women who I mentioned above. A typical post-feminist subject is a woman who doesn't identify as a feminist and thinks that feminism is unnecessary since gender equality has supposedly been achieved. Hence the post-feminism, thinking we live in a post-feminist world. Mm-hmm. She may vocally speak against feminism. You may have met a woman like this in your first year of university. She may have rolled her eyes when you mentioned your major. I know that happened to me multiple times.
No, never.
Now, a popular feminist doesn't decry feminism, but rather engages with the relatively sanitized, consumer-friendly brand of feminism. She may have felt moved to identify as a feminist after watching Beyoncé's 2014 VMAs performance, where she had the big feminists behind her in neon. Mm-hmm. Popular feminism, unsurprisingly, draws heavily on popular culture, consumer culture, and social media. This popular feminist woman has, in many cases, replaced the stereotypical militant man-hating feminist killjoy of the 90s and early 2000s as the archetypal feminist character in pop culture. And finally, you have the neoliberal feminist. And importantly, this doesn't refer to just anyone existing in neoliberal society who identifies as a feminist, but rather the neoliberal feminist is a woman who perpetuates the ethos of neoliberalism, such as meritocracy, consumerism, individualism, and packages it through the lens of empowerment and gender equality. So neoliberal feminists figuratively and literally capitalize off their self-identification as a feminist. So you see this in marketing of feminist merch. If you go on Etsy, you can get Ruth Bader Ginsburg mugs and Kamala Harris tea towels and all that kind of stuff. The rhetoric around female empowerment and the conferences that are held for women business leaders, et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to point out, like, I'm not trying to villainize anyone who is like a business owner who is a woman, or that there's no, people don't have purchasing power, and you know what stores you choose to go to doesn't make an impact. Mm-hmm. But this, we're talking much more in kind of like a corporate big picture world, not in like the person down the street who owns a bakery who is a woman. Mm-hmm. So in her book, The Rise of Neoliberal Feminism, Catherine Rottenberg writes, quote, "I understand neoliberalism not just as a set of economic policies, but as a dominant political rationality that moves to and from the management of the state to the inner workings of the subject, recasting individuals as human capital and thus capital enhancing agents." So the definition of neoliberalism varies based on who you ask, and I am not an economics major or poli-sci major, so I'm not the best person to tell you about it. But the definitions of neoliberalism varies based on who you ask. And some supporters of neoliberalism find the name pejorative and instead like to call it free market economics. Mm-hmm. Which, okay.
I mean, both are bad. I don't know.
That's terrible. The name's not the problem here.
Yeah, exactly.
But what matters mostly here for us is how neoliberalism perceives and shapes individuals as consumers and free agents. It tries to individualize systemic issues such as gender discrimination in the workplace. So the concept of the glass ceiling tends to focus on an individual woman's role in shattering the hierarchy of corporate America or Canada. Women are encouraged to lean in, to strive for the ever elusive having it all. Importantly, there's no discussion here in actually shattering systems of dominance and oppression. More women CEOs does not magically make workplace sexism go away. Mm-hmm. Another definition of neoliberal feminism I really like from the scholar Ida Ulus is, quote, "By neoliberal feminism, in this note, I mean feminism as embedded within the neoliberal agenda, in which welfare states and political structures for collective concerns are undermined or destroyed, while a market society emphasizing individual responsibility and choice is elevated." So what do you think about that quote?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like prioritizing, yes, like the free market and capitalism and capitalist ethics and morals, and like, I guess, capitalizing off of or co-opting the language of feminism in order to prioritize those things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like selling pink t-shirts being like International Women's Day. And, you know, meanwhile, those t-shirts are like manufactured in like the global South by women making like 5 cents a day. And it's like, feminism, you know? Yeah. That's, I guess, what it kind of, like, I feel like that quote really like illustrates that sort of feminism for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So neoliberal feminism is closely tied to what's called choice feminism, which is the concept that whatever choice I, a woman, make, it is inherently a feminist one. And you can see choice feminism and people saying, you know, well, I'm wearing makeup, but that's not, doesn't mean I'm, you know, pandering to the patriarchy. It's my choice. And there's a lot to say about, you know, how much choice you have within a system, but where I think choice feminism really gets weaponized is when women will make choices or perpetuate ideals such as being like a trad wife or a Republican or even a Democrat, where they are saying, because I am participating in this thing and I am a woman, it is feminist. I am kind of making this thing feminist, and therefore I cannot be criticized for being anti-feminist because it's my choice.
Right. Yeah. And then we saw that like in the liberal feminism, our first episode, where like this is a very old sort of idea in the history of feminism, where, you know, you had like early feminists like Mary Wollstonecraft being like, women should be in schools to make it a feminist space, although she wasn't, you know, using that exact language at the time. But you know, it's interesting to see how those ideals have perpetuated the rhetoric of feminism through the centuries.
Completely. And I also am a firm believer that you can be a feminist and make non-feminist choices. Mm-hmm. I know I do many of those. And when I was younger, I would try to kind of justify every single thing I did as feminist, and could go with like, well, here's why me watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians is actually feminist, blah, 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 blah. And then realizing that, first of all, I was wrong. And second of all, it didn't matter. Like, I think this happens when you look at feminism as kind of a political practice or something that you do versus feminism as some feminist as something that you identify, and the nuances of kind of how much weight you should put behind your actions and which actions actually have real meaningful ways to bring forward change. Mm-hmm. So with the discussion of choice feminism and purchasing power, I want to switch gears a bit and discuss one neoliberal feminist icon and break down her story, to kind of use as an example of neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. So I am dropping a picture into the doc now, and I want your opinion on it, if I can find it. Doo-doo.
That's good, because I was trying to figure out how to justify our watching of Love Island as a feminist act. I was like, well, I just don't know if I can do it.
Some things you just got to enjoy.
Yeah, you can just enjoy things and also be a feminist.
All right. Here you go.
Oh.
Do you please describe for the audience what I have just showed you?
We have a very attractive, thin, model-looking woman. She's wearing very interesting boots because they're almost like sandals, but they have very little toe coverage and then a lot of calf coverage, which is confusing. I don't understand if you would wear them on a hot day or a cold day. And then we have a dress, a shirt dress with kind of like a military sort of style arm. What do you call that? Epaulette or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And then a bit of a turtleneck. And she's standing cross-armed, looking deadpan at the camera, quite sassy looking. I don't know. Yeah.
Does this image look like something that's trying to sell you something?
Oh, yes. I think she's modeling me those garments, mm-hmm. is she not?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you know what company she is modeling for?
I have a theory.
What is your theory?
Is it Nasty Gal?
Yes, it is. So I want to talk to you about Nasty Gal,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which I'm not sure how much Nasty Gal existed within Canada.
Oh yeah, I've definitely purchased at least one item from Nasty Gal in my
Me
life.
Too.
Yeah.
It's a very 2015.
Yes. Mostly. It would have been around then, I think, when I discovered their website. And
So Nasty Gal as a company started as an eBay shop, where its founder, Sofia Amoroso, I think that's how you pronounce her last name, started selling vintage items. And what made the company so successful in the beginning, in the early 2010, was how all the clothes were really intentionally styled. And it was different, unlike then someone selling a vintage shirt where they just took a photo of the shirt on the floor and then you bought it. So from the beginning, Amoroso was selling like a look, a whole vibe that you purchased into. Mm. And she became incredibly successful from eBay. And eventually she left eBay and started her own website and began selling both vintage and contemporary clothing and accessories. And again, you would have a new drop of clothing that immediately would sell out. So in a few short years, Nasty Gal went from being an independent store on eBay to a multi-million dollar company based in Los Angeles. A lot of the kind of aesthetics of Nasty Gal are part 70s, 80s, vintage, a little bit like, say, Topshop, mm-hmm. but a little more grungy. Mm-hmm. Definitely seen as if you wanted to present as like a cool girl in a Netflix TV show about a high schooler, like you would buy stuff from Nasty Gal.
Yeah. I feel like I remember too, like a lot of kind of like kink appropriated, like a lot of like collars and like strappy things.
There was a lot of that kind of vibe. And also it wasn't cheap. So it mm-hmm. isn't like if you were getting, I don't know, a top from H&M or something. Mm-hmm. These things had more of a middle price point. And they had a fair amount of inventory. So there would be a lot of stuff on sale. They mm-hmm. weren't like one of those companies that, say, Outdoor Voices, which is another apparel brand that started by a young woman that also kind of grew too quickly, where they just don't ever put anything on sale as a way to preserve the exclusivity.
Right.
So Sofia Amoroso in 2015, which was kind of the height of her and her company's popularity, Forbes estimated her net worth to be $250 million.
Wow.
So most people got to really know Amoroso in the spring of 2014 when she published a book called Hashtag Girl Boss. So Hashtag Girl Boss, which I'm just going to refer to as Girl Boss because it's going to be really annoying to keep saying hashtag over and over again. It's kind of a Frankenstein of a book. It's part memoir, it's part business manual, it's part inspirational self-help, and the whole thing is written in a forced casual tone that brings to mind like BuzzFeed articles. Mm-hmm. I found this book online for free and read most of it, and oh boy,
did you read it like recently or yeah. Oh wow, okay.
I'm really dedicated to this podcast. One of the blurbs on the back of the book is from, unsurprisingly, Lena Dunham.
That is absolutely, yeah.
Girl Boss is more than a book. Girl Boss is a movement. Mm. And a movement it was. The book sold over 500,000 copies and was adapted into a critically panned Netflix series that I've somehow also watched.
Really?
Yes.
When was the Netflix series released?
Around 2015, 2016.
Was it good?
No. The love interest, though, is the love interest from Jennifer's Body. So. That's exciting.
I haven't seen that, although I do know of it. Megan Fox, right?
Yeah, revoke your feminist card.
Is it good? Should I watch it?
Jennifer's Body's good. You should definitely watch it.
Okay, I will.
We could talk about it.
Okay, great.
So Girl Boss, the book, was kind of the millennial version of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, which was published the year before. So Amoroso became a darling of the business world, and she was endlessly sharing her rags to riches story. So in brief, she was a self-described anarchist and crust punk, never went to college, kind of bumping around the Bay Area, and then started selling vintage clothing because she liked vintage clothing. And then her business kind of blew up. So she went from this kind of anarchist to the CEO of a highly successful company. And the publisher Business Insider ran a profile on her in 2014 that was titled, quote, "How Nasty Gal Sophia Amoroso is Making Feminism Cool Again." So how was she making feminism cool again? Well, I perused her book to see what she had to say about feminism and whatnot. And I came up pretty empty-handed. Towards the beginning of the book, she questions whether or not Girl Boss is a feminist manifesto, and then writes, quote, "Girl Boss is a feminist book, and Nasty Gal is a feminist company, in the sense that I encourage you, as a girl, to be who you want and do what you want, but I'm not here calling us women with a Y and blaming men for all my struggles along the way." Oof. So I would argue that this is more of like a post-feminist take on feminism.
Yeah.
She's distancing herself from the struggles and men being bad and women with a Y, while also trying to claim to be a feminist in some way. And what I think's most telling about her in her book is when she talks about capitalism. So again, pretty early on, she says, quote, "I entered adulthood believing that capitalism was a scam, but I've instead found that it's a kind of alchemy. You combine hard work, creativity, and self-determination, and things start to happen. And once you start to understand that alchemy, or even just recognize it, you can begin to see the world in a different way."
Oof.
Yes. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine if you're worth $250 million, capitalism does. It is very appealing to you. So I feel like she's probably not the best person to give a hot take on capitalism.
No, and she's using her past self being kind of like a drifter, a dumpster diver, as a way to kind of add like authenticity to her take on capitalism. But she's telling us this in a business manual. You know, a lot of what she talks about is like how to grow your business and how mm-hmm. to hustle and how to be a girl boss. And when she says like you combine hard work, creativity, and self-determination and things start to happen, that's kind of like the definition of meritocracy, of the American mm-hmm. dream. It's what people think of when they think of like a self-made woman.
Oh yeah.
And that's just not realistic. And also, in the book, she talks about and kind of acknowledges the other people who helped her. And they're really, though, not given any sort of real spotlight in terms of just like how any business, like any community, is like a somewhat collaborative space.
Yeah.
And a big critique that employees of hers had was that kind of she was going around hawking this book, taking all this credit, and not acknowledging all of the people who are working really hard for this company.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that is like neoliberalism. It values so much the individual. And that's why, you know, you have people like Elon Musk who have like become billionaires off of like the labor and like ingenuity of other people. And he's like recognized as this like innovator. And it's like, from what I understand, he's actually done very little innovation.
Yeah.
He's just bought a lot and profited off of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's going to take us all to Mars.
Yeah. I don't want to go to Mars.
Me neither. I saw that movie.
There's no water. It sounds bad.
It's also like within neoliberalism, there's no... It doesn't recognize or doesn't want to recognize that everyone can't be a self-made millionaire.
Yeah.
But that's just not how it works.
Yeah.
And so when you're being told that like the key to financial stability is just, you know, having a side hustle and doing, you know, determination and passion and networking and mentorship, that just only really speaks about a certain type of job to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and a certain type of person who can be part of that job.
Yeah. Well, and often it means, you know, like having rich parents.
Yeah.
Or something that, like that. Did she have rich parents? Do we know?
From what I've heard, not really.
Okay.
She did start her company and went back home to kind of work on it.
Mm-hmm.
So unsurprisingly, the bubble of Nasty Gal and Amoroso images, it popped.
Mm-hmm.
In January of 2015, she announced that she was stepping down as CEO. Part of what she said was because she really wasn't qualified to be the CEO, which is true, but also she was marketing herself as the, you don't need a college degree to be CEO. And I'm not someone who's going around saying you need a college degree to do anything, however, except for maybe medicine.
Yeah. Might be a good one, I guess.
It was a bit of a disconnect, kind of what she was peddling outwards versus what was happening in her company.
Mm-hmm.
In March of 2015, a former employee filed a lawsuit alleging that this employee, she was fired after becoming pregnant and requesting maternity leave. The suit also alleges that 4 women and 1 man were laid off after becoming pregnant and or giving birth and or taking maternity or paternity leave. Also mm-hmm. part of the lawsuit was someone who was looking to undergo a kidney transplant and was kind of experienced anger that she would have to be taking medical leave. So this goes back to a female CEO does not a feminist company make.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, you know, issues around maternity leave, which, you know, in the States, there's no mandatory, you don't need any, there's basically no maternity leave. It really varies.
Really?
Yes. But if I work at, you know, some whatever restaurant and I get pregnant and the government doesn't need to, there's no kind of big mandate around needing maternity leave.
That's unreal.
And yeah, but that's a real problem that like a lot of people face, and that's not something that really gets discussed as strongly as it should in the world of kind of girl boss and lean in and everything.
Right.
The same way with like the Me Too movement, you know, is focusing so much on Hollywood and the music industry and stuff, and really kind of losing its roots, which are based in like, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace in situations like if you work at a fast food restaurant
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And yeah, I would argue that we should be focusing much more on, you know, the working class and how working class marginalized people deal with workplace discrimination and harassment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's much sexier if you focus on celebrities, but unfortunately, you know, that's not where the majority of these things are happening or the people that they're affecting. And also, they're the people that have resources, the wealthy. Yep. And it's like the working class people that don't have access to the resources that you know, are affected so much more adversely by these things.
Yeah. And through 2015 and 2016, Mastigal went through multiple rounds of layoffs, and the general sentiment from ex-employees on like job review sites such as Glassdoor was that Mastigal was a toxic, dysfunctional workplace and far from the hashtag girl boss image its founder was projecting. Mm-hmm. And in the fall of 2016, the company filed for bankruptcy, and it was later purchased by the Boohoo Group.
Oh.
You can still buy Mastigal online. I checked their website today and everything is 55% off.
Oh.
So I don't know if that's a new strategy for making money or if it's kind of like a clearinghouse, everything must go.
Right.
Thing. But when we think about kind of neoliberalism and like the story of Mastigal, like I kind of am left thinking like, what can we take from this? Mm-hmm. Women in leadership positions in a company doesn't make a feminist business. This ties back to our discussion about like Kamala Harris and mm-hmm. women in the army and whatnot, like just adding women and adding, you know, marginalized people into a bad system isn't going to like fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times companies can use the fact that they have like a woman in power as a way to kind of distance themselves from any real change in terms of like workers' rights or environmental responses or anything like that.
Yeah. I saw the most amazing tweet the other day, like talking about the ocean being on fire, you know, where that, mm-hmm. And it was a tweet that like had a picture of the image. It was like, this is what happens when men are in power. Like we need more women in the oil industry.
Jesus. Yeah. Like, that's yeah. It.
More women lighting the ocean on fire. That's what we need. I thought it must have been a joke. And then I looked at the person's Twitter page and it was not a joke. It was very serious.
I mean, yeah, the meme format of like they hate to see a girl boss winning. My favorite one of that is the ship that was blocking the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
They hate to see a girl boss winning. But another thing about Mastigal and Amoroso is there's so many stories just like this one. For example, the co-working space The Wing and its founder Audrey Gelman, where there are lots of issues of racism and The Wing kind of closed, they really profited off of being like a feminist space and had an insane amount of merch around, you know, like whatever, smashing the patriarchy. There's a great article that I'll link about The Wing in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Thinks Period Undies is another story of a kind of startup. Its founder, Mickey Agarwal, who's a Montreal hometown hero.
Really?
ended up leaving after sexual harassment complaints.
Wow.
And Away Suitcases, which I guess are like a trendy suitcase thing. The two founders, Jen Rubio and Steph Curry, multiple employees alleged against like bullying, that they were being bullies and whatnot. So yeah, this isn't like a new story. And this is one you saw a lot specifically around like 2012. To like 2020, and conservatives and misogynists can kind of try to spin the downfall of these companies as trying to show that women shouldn't be in business or something. I'm not quite sure. I've seen some bad hot takes.
Yeah.
And yeah, the last thing also is I don't think choice feminism is real feminism. Maybe that's where I'll leave it. I choose not to think that choice feminism is feminism. And again, like I think there are real ways that choices you make can have a feminist impact. And then there are also things where every choice you make does not and cannot be feminist.
Yeah.
And there can be real harm in weaponizing the language of feminism into the world of like capitalism, for example. And that's really what neoliberal feminism has done.
Yeah.
Things that used to be feminist issues, like, second wave feminist issue. And it all kind of changed to being issues around like empowerment and women in the workplace and like women as consumers, instead of looking at real like emancipatory, liberatory change.
Yeah. Well, and it sucks because it kind of takes this thing and it distorts it and manipulates it into a thing that it doesn't even resemble itself anymore. You know, it's like, it's a, just like a narrative through which to like sell pink t-shirts through, instead of like, being, you know, a radical thought and, you know, rooted in liberation and emancipation and like undoing systems of violence and oppression. And instead it just like doesn't even resemble itself anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's also, really interesting what you were just going back to your previous point, like how this could be like also weaponized as like a reason behind why not to have women in your company. And I feel like we've talked a lot about how like putting women into spaces or organizations doesn't make it feminist, but also we're not advocating for not including women in spaces. It's just like, I think at least what I'm trying to get across through like our kind of, I guess we've had a bit of a theme for the last few episodes, is that I think popular feminism would say that it often is just that, you know, it is just including women in spaces. And I think we're trying to sort of challenge that by thinking about feminism as a more, or just more critically, mm-hmm. I guess, and as like a system of like interconnected thoughts and, you know, like anti-racist approaches and like queer friendly approaches. And it's not just simply the inclusion of cis women into spaces, but like it's a multitude of things and it's a culmination of things and they interconnect and it's not that simple.
Yeah, and you can't solve this by buying a book that you can buy at Urban Outfitters with a nice millennial pink cover.
It'll look great on your coffee table.
It really will. that's, I think, all I've got to say about neoliberal feminism.
Well, that was awesome. Thanks, Eva.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week, I think.
We'll be back next week.
What are we talking about next week?
Going to talk about Margaret Sanger and her sister Ethel Byrne and the founding of Planned Parenthood and a kind of sliding door story of what happened and what could have happened.
Right on. I can't wait.
Thanks so much for listening.
See you next week.